I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Birds in North America have been disappearing at an alarming rate over the last 50 years. According to a report in the journal Science, the bird population has dropped by almost 30%. That's nearly 3 billion birds in just the United States and Canada. Ken Rosenberg from the Cornell University Laboratory of Ornithology and a lead author of the study said his and his team found that many of the missing birds are familiar species: sparrows, warblers, blackbirds, finches, starlings, swallows, and some are non-native species. There is some good news, though, for birds and bird lovers. In the report, waterfowl and raptor populations are on the rise. Today in Radio Times, we assess the findings of the report, the threats to birds from climate change and tall glass-windowed buildings to cats and pesticides, and what we can do to support bird populations and their habitats. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios. Jason Weckstein is Associate Curator of Ornithology at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University, where he's an Associate Professor in the Department of Biodiversity, Earth, and Environmental Science. Jason Weckstein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us, Robert Curry is a Professor of Biology at Villanova University and a past President of the Wilson Ornithological Society. And Robert Curry, nice to have you with us as well.
Great to be here.
Nice to have you both with us, and we have much to talk about. Let me just toss out the phone numbers and ways that folks can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We know we have a lot of birders in our audience. Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jason, let me begin with you and the head of the National Audubon Society describing this report, called it a full-blown crisis. Do you see it that way?
Well, I mean, we've known for a long time that lots of bird populations are, you know, going down in numbers. You know, if you, you know, growing up, I birded Point Pelee as a teenager. And, you know, the old timers would say that, you know, the migration, you know, phenomena that we'd see, these big fallouts of migrant birds, were much smaller than they remembered seeing, you know, in their earlier days.
Just anecdotally.
Yeah, so anecdotally, we've known that there are problems. We know that we've destroyed habitats. We've known that prairie birds were on the decline, for example. And this is one of the things that the study shows, is that grassland birds are on the decline. I think this is just quantifying some of those results. The other side of the coin is that there are some positive things in the study that are showing that, you know, some of the birds that you mentioned, waterfowl, birds of prey, those are on the incline. And I think that, you know, the study is sort of a general overview of patterns out there. Now we need to get to the specifics and really drill into, you know, what's really going on. Because some of these things, you know, we may get some slightly different results if we look at the details of some of the specific species.
I mean, I have no idea how you conduct research like this, how you can know, Robert Curry, that there were missing 3 billion birds, knowing what that sort of vast expanse this report covers.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's really notable about the study is that they combined many different data sources. So they relied on programs, some of which have been going back more than 50 years. The study covers 50 years, but some of the programs from which they drew the data go back much farther than that. So, for example, one is called the Breeding Bird Survey, which was founded by Chan Robbins many decades ago, where people go to specific spots and drive a route where they count how many birds they detect during the breeding season in the same spot year after year across all of the United States and the parts of Canada where people can get to with roads.
Exactly,
so
right.
There is it's limited in what you can do in the far north where there aren't any roads, but because it's a road-based survey. But that's just one example of the data sources that they were able to draw on. But they also combined the information from those surveys, where it was done the same way every year for a very long time over a very big geographic area. And then they brought in additional data sources. For example, a section of the report is about migratory birds, which especially species that breed in the far north, where the surveys don't reach the surveys during the breeding season don't reach those species, we can detect them during migration because they've got to come south if they're migratory species. So if you track those using radar technology and other new methods. So the time frame is shorter, but still the mm-hmm. quality of the data is very good for assessing the number of birds migrating. Most of these are at night. So the weather radar and those kinds of radar that you see on TV, you'll see a big blob on the radar screen. Those are birds. And there are ways to calibrate the numbers.
So we could maybe quibble with the numbers, but it is saying that we are experiencing in the United States and Canada pretty severe bird loss. And I think it's interesting, Jason, that some of the more sort of what we think of as common birds, they seem to be, at least according to this report, affected in loss of sparrows and more birds that we see in our own backyard.
Yeah, I mean, things like red-winged blackbirds are apparently on the decline, according to, you know, to the results of the study. And there, you know, there's the flip side to this. I mean, one possibility that that's, you know, a colleague has made some comments about is that some of these things that are on the decline, like grackles, red-winged blackbirds, these are sort of edge species. And it's possible that, you know, some of that habitat's actually growing back up. And maybe we're actually, in those cases, actually getting back to sort of pre-European size populations. This is one criticism of those specific species. And this is where I think, you know, there's a lot of room to now take this study and go further to drill into the specifics of these different groups of birds. I mean, there are definitely things that are, you know, that we really need to worry about.
Robert, also seemingly affected, according to this report, were non-native species of birds. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to me that opens up a whole other discussion about what are those birds doing there.
Yeah, it's a fairly small subset in terms of the number of species. It's only about a dozen or 10 of the species included in the study, which was more than 500. So a small subset of those are non-native species, some of which have been in North America for hundreds of years or more than 100 years. Some of those are increasing. So one example is a bird called the Eurasian collared dove that came in from escapees in Bahamas in the 1970s, and now it's exploded across most of North America, wow. Southern, maybe not in Canada, but they're very widespread now. So they're increasing. But on the other hand, a bird that everybody is familiar with is the house sparrow. If you see a sparrow hopping along a city street in Philly or New York or anywhere, that's probably a house sparrow. They're not native. They were brought in the 1800s and exploded across all of the New World. But their numbers are down now. And that's a little harder to understand because they're not out in the countryside as much. They're mostly in towns and cities. So something's going on with them, and that one is really hard to piece out, to figure out what the phenomenon is. But their numbers are big, so they drive some of these declines.
Well, and it's interesting to piece all the numbers together. There is some good news here, mm-hmm. Jason, in that waterfowl staging a comeback, or at least their population's growing, raptors as well. What does that tell us, and why?
Well, I think it tells us a few things. One, it tells us that these are groups of organisms that did have declines in their populations. You know, hawks are famous in our region. Cape May used to be a place where people would go to shoot hawks. Hawk Mountain was a place that people would go to shoot, you know, birds of prey. We stopped that, you know, so we created legislation that made that illegal. We also had problems with DDT. We found out that DDT was causing eggshell thinning, and this actually comes from museum collections like ours at the Academy. There were eggs in specimen collections, and scientists were able to compare those eggs and museum specimen collections. There was sort of a tradition of collecting eggs, just like bird specimens. These eggs would be collected and then cleaned out, and the scientists were able to look at the thickness of these old eggs and compare them to eggs after the use of DDT, and basically were able to show that there was a correlation between use of DDT and eggshell thinning. And we also, you know, we knew that birds were crushing their eggs on the nests. So once we were able to stop DDT, those populations rebounded. So a combination of stopping illegal shooting of raptors and then reducing these pesticides that were causing a problem.
I mean, that seems on the one hand kind of simple, like don't do this.
Yep.
Go ahead, Robert Curry.
Well, the DDT story, which was publicized back in the 1960s by Rachel Carson. You know, that was
the
beginning of the environmental movement. She was a major force in kicking off the environmental movement, because the numbers of birds like bald eagle and peregrine falcon and a lot of other raptors were so low, and we knew that this phenomenon was happening, that their reproduction was being wiped out by their own eggs being too brittle.
And especially sitting on their eggs and killing their young.
And these were species at the top of the food chain, because DDT is a synthetic insecticide that accumulates up through the food chain. So it's the animals, not just birds, but other animals too. But birds, because they lay hard-shelled eggs, the way DDT affected them was exaggerated in birds as opposed to mammals. So it was really obvious that this was happening. But as you said, that was a relatively easy fix. Although, on the other hand, you can walk into a hardware store in South America or other parts of the developing world and buy DDT off the shelf to sprinkle it on your bed to kill bed bugs, as an example. So in some places, what's worse, the pollution from DDT or people dying of diseases transmitted by insect pests, where
this
DDT
is
an important control? So we've banned it in North America, but the same product is still available in other parts of the world, which means that the addition of DDT in the food chain is still happening in other parts of the world.
Well, and there are pesticides, Jason, that are affecting bird populations. I'm going to mispronounce it. It begins with an N.
Neonicotinoids.
Neonicotinoids.
I think is the
name. Yes.
Yeah. There was a recent study published. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Neonicotinoids. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And what does that do?
I don't know the answer to that,
okay.
To be honest.
You know the answer to that. Go ahead, Bob Gurdy.
Neonics is the nickname. they're used very widely now as one of the main insecticides. So they use them in two ways, agricultural folks. They put them on seeds. So when they are planting seeds, many seed crops, corn, wheat, barley, all those things, the seeds are treated with neonicotinoids before they go in the ground. So one group of birds, including these sparrows that are getting clobbered in the survey, are eating them when they're feeding in the fields during migration and also other times of the year, but especially in the spring. The seeds are out in the spring. The birds are migrating. They're eating these seeds. And a recent study, important study, just found that during migration, the birds that have fed a lot on these, they actually did it experimentally, they dosed them with this insecticide to see what would happen. What happened was it didn't mess up their navigation route, but it caused them to lose hunger. They don't get hungry. So it's like nicotine. You're not as hungry. So the birds weren't eating as much as they should have, which forced them to stay longer at the stopover sites during migration, which is going to mean that they're going to be late at arriving on the breeding grounds. Even though they're going in the right direction, it didn't mess up their navigation, but they're not getting there at the right time. And that probably is going to hurt their success once they get there.
And that just proves how complicated
yes.
this all is. That's Robert Curry. Jason Weckstein joining us on Radio Times. We are talking about birds, the bird population, a new study in the journal Science. And we're going to take a short break and then get back to our conversation. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times. Here on WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Jason Weckstein. He's Associate Curator of Ornithology at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University, Robert Curry, Professor of Biology at Villanova University. We are talking about bird populations and conservation, a new study in the journal Science about some of the threats to bird species, what's behind the declines, and what individuals, people like you and me, can do to support our avian friends. Let me just pick up on, there was something you were saying just off the air, Robert. I just want to make sure our listeners hear about this having to do with the neonics that you were talking about.
Right. Well, this is the second component of the way that insecticides like neonics can affect bird populations is the agricultural folks use it to protect the crops after they've sprouted as well. Well, that's not going to affect the birds directly, but the reason they're spraying it on the crops is to knock down the insect populations, herbivores that would feed on the corn or whatever. But birds rely, a lot of birds rely on insects, especially during the breeding season. So there's broad concern around the world from several studies about a comparable drop in insect abundance and diversity. So it's possible, it's quite likely that some of the agricultural practices, both in the type of methods they use, including using specific pesticides like neonics that hurt honeybees, for example, and also the extent, just the, you know, how much of our land is covered with agriculture, it's changing the availability of food for some birds, and that is probably also driving some of these declines, especially of species in grassland areas, which is where the agriculture is.
Sure, sure. Well, and I wonder, Jason, with the thought of DDT, what we did with DDT, whether we can apply that to these, some of these pesticides being used now that are affecting not just birds, but also the insects that the birds munch on.
Sure. Yeah, it makes sense that, that we need to do that. If these things are having this kind of a negative effect on insects and birds, they're obviously also potentially having that effect on us, right? The other thing is, you know, Bob just mentioned this, you know, a lot of these birds rely on grassland habitats that were alongside agricultural areas. And I think agriculture has changed historically too. We have less of that sort of edge habitat. And as a result, some of these grassland birds, their populations are, you know, going down because there isn't habitat anymore along the roadsides, between the fields and the roadsides.
Can we extrapolate from this study looking at the United States and Canada? Can we extrapolate, Jason, to other parts of the world? Let's say, is Europe experiencing the same kind of bird population declines? Do we know?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is, you know, we were talking about house sparrows earlier, these introduced species. It turns out that house sparrows are having problems in Europe. So, you know, this thing that we sort of consider a pest, an introduced pest, is actually having problems in Europe as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe this is a canary in the coal mine. Maybe here in the United States, it's because we managed to get rid of these sorts of birds. It's hard to know. But I think we need to pay attention to it and figure out what, you know, why specifically we're seeing fewer house sparrows, why we're seeing fewer starlings, and why we're seeing fewer native birds especially.
Let me read a couple of comments and we'll get Dave from Maple Glen to join us. Kevin says on our Facebook page, I've been a pretty hardcore birder since 1973 and the decline is very noticeable and depressing to those of us out there in the field. Hold on to that thought. Let me get Dave from Maple Glen to join us. And Dave, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. An important show indeed. I'm 70 years old, so I've lived through the whole 50-year decline in birds. And I'm somebody who, you know, was outdoors living in the woods practically as a young person and still go out. And the difference is astonishing. When I used to go out in the woods in my 20s and teens, that it was like being in a jungle. There was like bird sounds everywhere. There was almost no silence. It was like a, you know, cacophony of birds. And now when I go in the woods, it's this eerie dead silence. And it's not just the birds that are missing, but insects. No sounds from insects, just one or two kind of insects. And at night, you look at the streetlights that used to be covered with a cloud of insects, and they're just nothing.
Hmm.
So I just pass that on. It's really scary to see.
Well, both of our guests are
not here.
I appreciate, Dave, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I mean, this is a birder, lifelong birder, and basically experiencing something. And I wonder to you, Robert Curry, have you had that same experience? We just feel like we hear less birds, less insects.
Yeah, that it depends on where you go and what kinds of birds you're focusing on. I have not spent a lot of time in the Midwest, so I haven't personally, I don't have any experience with those declines in the prairie birds. But I have friends who are from the Midwest who have talked about it. And so one of the species that popped out as having declined tremendously is a grassland bird called longspur. And their numbers are down by tens or hundreds of millions. So it used to be a very widespread bird in the high plains, and their numbers are plummeting, just as one example. In my own experience, one of the groups that where I've seen changes are migrating shorebirds. Although in the study, that wasn't a group that jumped out as having declined in overall, But in my experience, some of the places that I've gone over my lifetime in on the East Coast,
Cape May,
places,
I'm thinking.
Well, Cape May and up in the Maritime provinces, there are places where we used to see flocks of tens of millions of shorebirds during migration, and now it's maybe a million. So the decline there, I can see it because I spent a lot of time visiting those spots. Some of the in our field work. It's very complicated because it varies so much from year to year. So it's hard to really appreciate long-term trends, but it does seem like some of the forest species, the migratory warblers that are mentioned in the study, that used to be very diverse and abundant in our study sites are fewer now. But we don't quantify those, so I don't really have that information.
Yeah, I'm curious, Jason. You've done some work in the Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Are we seeing... I'm thinking about the fires of recent
months.
Yeah,
I mean, the Amazon, you know, one of the big issues there is that, you know, a lot of us think of the Amazon as a big green uniform carpet, right? And, you know, if you fly over parts of the Amazon, the Western Amazon, you know, this is still the, you know, the largest, most intact tropical forest, you know, lowland tropical forest ecosystem on the planet. But it's not really one uniform green carpet. These major rivers actually form barriers for species. Many of the birds, you know, approximately 50% of the birds in any given area don't cross over those rivers. And as a result, these little chunks of land between the major rivers, and these are big rivers, right? These are rivers that make the Mississippi look like a little creek in a lot of ways. Basically, those areas are like islands, and they have their own unique biodiversity within them. So the work that we're doing is, you know, using genetic data to study birds in these areas to sort of define the differences between these populations across the basin. So the bottom line is, when you think about conservation in the Amazon, you can't just conserve Western Amazonia or Central Amazonia or Eastern Amazonia. You actually have to conserve parts of all of it. And unfortunately, that the forest fire or the fires that we're seeing that are, you know, burning away at the forest and sort of picking away at the edge of the forest, those are happening in Southern Amazonia and Eastern Amazonia, and those are the places that have the least forest left over.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So they're having you know, big conservation impacts.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Jason Weckstein. He's Associate Curator of Ornithology at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University here in Philadelphia. Robert Curry, Professor of Biology at Villanova University, just outside of Philadelphia, talking about birds, bird populations, some of the threats to birds. And you can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We talked about pesticides in terms of threats to bird populations. Well, let's talk about tall buildings. And we know, what are they called? Bird strikes, when birds essentially fly, Jason, fly into these tall buildings, especially if they've got lots of windows or, yep, or glass covered.
And lights, too. Lights are important. If you turn lights out, you get less bird strikes on buildings.
From the bird's perspective, what is... They don't see the building?
They don't see the building, or they see a reflection. And what's happening in a lot of places where we get lots of bird strikes, so Philadelphia, we get bird strikes, but it's not on the same scale as many cities. So places like Chicago, Toronto, New York, where you've got a large body of water. And, you know, Bob mentioned earlier that these birds are, many of these species are migrating at night. And when the weather conditions are right, in a place like Chicago, the birds end up out over Lake Michigan. So if they're in the springtime, if the winds are coming out of the southwest, the birds end up over Lake Michigan. And then they have to battle their way into shore in the morning at dawn. Mm. And this sort of gets back to sort of all the drives of migration. So they're working to get back to shore so that they can feed like crazy. This is this hyperphagy that Bob was talking about, that he was saying the neonics turn off. Well, these birds have to put this layer of fat on to move, you know, to move north, you know, the next day.
Sure.
Anyways, they're working hard to get into shore, and these buildings are there, and the lights are on, and they see reflections and meet their end.
And they,
in many cases,
fly into the building and die. I was reading something like 600 million birds die every year in Canada and in the U.S. because of essentially Bob Curry flying into buildings.
Yeah, and it's important to appreciate that it's not only the tall buildings. You think of how many residential homes there are scattered across the landscape. A lot of birds hit those windows too in people's backyards. And because there are a lot more buildings, the number there is probably on a par with the numbers in the cities. the differences in the cities with the taller buildings and the lights, it's a more concentrated phenomenon, and there have been studies to quantify that. Mm-hmm. But we participated in a study across a whole bunch of universities looking at different buildings on our campuses, and we all found a lot of birds on these are buildings that are maybe two or three stories high. But if they're built poorly with a lot of glass and, for example, glass where there's vegetation nearby, the birds don't see the glass. They see the reflection of the vegetation, and they think they can fly right through.
Oh, wow.
But the good news on that is that there are ways that you can make the glass more evident to the birds. Dan Clem, who's a professor at Muhlenberg College, is one of the experts on the methods that we can use to reduce window strikes. It's more putting markings on the windows, but they have to be designed in a very specific way so the birds see it. If you just put a sticker of a hawk on a window, that's not going to work because the birds just realize it's a sticker. And the rest of it is glass, and they think they can fly right by. No, it's more like a pattern that makes them realize that it's an entire opaque surface, and it's that they can't get through any of it. So dots in a row spaced a certain way, or lines spaced just right so that the birds know they can't fly through, they can't fit through. But it doesn't have to take up very much of the glass. It just has to be a well-designed etching or stickers on the glass.
So they'll actually see that, oh, my gosh, this is a building, and I don't want to fly into it. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about cats. I mean, cats, again, 2.4 billion birds killed every year by cats.
Yeah, this is one of the biggest killers of birds. And is
that in America or?
That was from a study done in the United States, right? So you start extrapolating this across the world, and anywhere you travel, you see feral cats. And we're not just talking about feral cats. They're obviously the biggest part of the problem, but people that are letting their pet cats outside are also doing a disservice to birds.
There's a park that I go, and there are lots of feral cats in there, and I see some, I'll say, lovely ladies who come and feed the cats. I mean, what do we do about feral cats?
Well, the reality is we need to get them out of the ecosystem. They're not native, and it's not an easy situation. And, you know, obviously these people who are feeding the cats really mean well, right?
Totally
they care about the animals. But if they do the math and start thinking about the animals that they care about, they should think about the birds. I mean, the billions of native birds, and that's only birds. These things are killing even more mammals. They're killing reptiles. So they're having a huge impact on the ecosystem. And really, you know, the solutions, you know, feeding them using trap neuter release doesn't work. We know that.
They're cats.
Yep, they're cats.
I mean, they're predators.
Yep, that's what they do for a living.
Yeah. Anything you want to add to that, Bob?
No, just that Pete Mara, who's one of the authors on the new study, the abundance study, is also one of the experts on trying to measure the impact of cats, and his research is very extensive and careful, and it's overwhelmingly convincing that the impact is huge. And there also have been some very good, rigorous studies measuring on a local level the dynamic between the feral cats and the wildlife populations. And as Jason said, it's not just birds, it's chipmunks and all sorts of other things. So it's pretty clear that the only real way to control that is to reduce the numbers of cats that are out there. There are a variety of ways you can do that, but including encouraging people to not let their cat feed outside or wander outside.
That might be a good place to start, right?
Yeah. But in some places, we can also target our efforts where there are some places where the impact of a cat population is disproportionately bad. So in places like Hawaii, where you've got a lot of native species that are struggling for a lot of reasons, well, having feral cats add to the toll is you know, that's could be the straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of putting species over the edge. And so where you've got endangered species that are getting hit by cats, as well as other phenomena like habitat loss and window strikes and climate change, which we haven't gotten to
yet.
We will get to climate change,
I promise.
But so there's a general phenomenon, but there's also a more acute problem in specific areas. So if we focus our efforts and work on the worst problems first and then try to build understanding and work out from there, we can get it done.
And you know, when we have things like wildlife refuges, we don't want feral cats. And, you know, our own wildlife refuge here in Philly, which is a fantastic birding area, the first time I brought my ornithology class there, right below the bird feeder, there were four feral cats. And it's an urban wildlife refuge, so people, I think, dump their cats there when they don't want them.
Tommy says, keep your cat inside, enjoy her longer life and fewer illnesses and injuries.
Yes.
Joe says, let's remember the adage, canary in the coal mine. Our feathered friends are on the environmental front lines. Do you see it that way, Jason, in terms of the kind of threats to if the bird population is under attack, then are the rest of us under attack in a sense?
Sure. I think in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, these organisms provide services for us too. You know, so they're the canaries in the coal mine. They disperse seeds. They, you know, hummingbirds help pollinate some plants. The insects that we kill with pesticides pollinate plants. So we need to pay attention to this stuff.
What should we do? I mean, is it a matter of, I mean, we're not gonna take down the buildings that we have built. We do have agriculture that takes up a lot of land. I mean, I don't see us not doing that. We have about a minute before our first break here, or our second break, I should say. Robert Curry, just sort of broadly speaking, what should we do as a species ourselves?
Well, the list of problems that we know are the birds are facing and are driving these changes is a long list. And so there are things we can do to address a lot of them. We've already talked about cats, and there are ways to deal with that. We've talked about building strikes. There are ways to retrofit buildings with, if you've got a building where you know it's a problem building, you can add the protection on the glass that will reduce the impact. So those are fairly simple,
sure,
practical things if we just put the money up.
With buildings, you can also pull the shades. David Willard has studied this since the 1970s at McCormick Place in Chicago, and when the shades are pulled, many fewer birds are killed.
Oh, so interesting. I'll tell you what, only because I asked you something right before a break, and I know you have more to say, but let's take that break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about birds, the threat to our bird populations, and Jason Weckstein is our guest, along with Robert Curry, and you can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation with any questions or comments. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Again, talking with Robert Curry, professor of biology at Villanova University. He's also a past president of the Wilson Ornithological Society. Jason Weckstein is with us as well. He's associate curator of ornithology at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University, where he's an associate professor in the Department of Biodiversity, Earth, and Environmental Science. We are talking about birds in this hour of Radio Times. And again, you can join the conversation 1-888-477-9499. Let me ask you about windmills. And that's something else that I've seen, that is a potential threat to bird populations. Who should I toss that to? I guess I'm looking at you, Bob Curry.
Well, wind turbines are proliferating. We see them all over the place now. And there's some evidence that they do cause some mortality of birds. The biggest issue with wind turbines is where you put them. That's one of the big issues. Because if you put them on a ridge top that the birds are going to follow during migration, or if you put them on a point of land where the birds are going to go through that point, they have to go through that point as they're migrating, you're going to have problems. And it hits some species more than others because it depends on the height. So some species are okay because they fly up above the windmills, the turbines. But there are definitely species that get hit hard. So we need more work to understand what are best practices for where we put the windmills, turbines. there's also potential for redesigning turbines. So instead of having the big windmill sort of turbines that rotate sideways, there are vertical turbines that spin on their axis, and that's not going to hit the birds. Now, the engineering, the physics of making those efficient is more difficult, but there are some prototypes that have been promising. And then there are also some things we can do to try to deter birds, so try to encourage the birds to go around the turbines. But for example, some of the offshore turbine installations, I don't think there's as much concern about those. I have to admit, I'm not an expert on that particular question. But if it's out in the open ocean, I would think that most seabirds would be pretty good at just working around them. But again, I'm not sure about that. Whereas if you put the same turbine right on the coast where the birds are migrating down the shoreline, you're going to have a problem.
So right, often where there's often where there's wind, it's these good places for birds to migrate. Yep. So you often do see turbines get put up in places that are decent for bird migration.
Well, I saved climate change for last, which is the impact, Jason, of climate change on bird populations, on things like migration. How should we understand that?
Well, I mean, we don't even know the full extent to how it's going to affect things, right?
We're talking about warming climates.
Right. But, we know that some birds are showing up to their breeding grounds earlier, and there are all kinds of pieces that have to come together for birds to breed and be successful. And, if we change that clock in one organism and it's not affecting their food organism responds in a different way, who knows what's going to happen? Bob's work on chickadees has shown that these chickadee hybrid zones are moving as climate changes. These birds are moving north. So there are effects.
And my understanding, very rudimentary, is that it's sunlight that causes migration. I mean, it's sort of how much sunlight there is, but that doesn't coincide.
Change in day length.
Day length.
So especially the long distance migrants are warblers and thrushes and birds like that, that many of them spend the winter in South America or Central America. The timing of their migration is not likely to change with climate change because they have evolved to time their migration to match the day length, the date that tells them, it's the right date to go. But what's happening with climate change is it may no longer be the correct date because they may get to the breeding grounds and what evolutionarily had timed them to match a peak of insect availability in, say, early June, those insects may have already come and gone in May because they are not tuned to day length. They'll be tuned to when do the buds pop out and when do the new leaves grow.
Or what's the temperature, the right temperature.
Sure. Yeah. And those are things that are definitely changing. So you get different patterns with migratory species where the impacts are these mismatches where they're following one schedule and it's no longer the right schedule, but it takes generations, hundreds of years for evolutionary changes in those migratory schedules to happen. Natural selection is probably heading in that direction, but it's going to take a very long time. And we don't know whether the birds can adapt quickly enough over many generations to cope. And in the meantime, they may just die out.
Jason, you want to add something?
Yeah, we also know, so there have been some resurvey projects that have used museum collections. So basically, University of California, Berkeley has done sort of a series of studies where they've resurveyed places that were studied, where museum specimens were collected earlier in the century. And basically, they can show that that vertebrates like birds are moving up mountains. So they're responding to climate change by moving up mountains. Now, they can only go so far, and suddenly there's not any mountain to go. So,
and just the complexities, I guess, of natural selection. Because if you're going by one date to go north or south, but the food isn't there when you get there, then you're not going to make it, right? I mean, in the most sort of unscientific way of describing that.
Well, we suspect that a lot of populations are going to respond both in the long term through evolutionary changes of gradually changing their migratory timing. But they can also shift in the short term and on a more ecological timescale without necessarily an evolutionary change. They just will go to a place where the climate is the right temperature for them. So if it's a bird that normally in the past would have migrated to Philadelphia or lived here year-round and lived in this region, and it's too hot here now, they will gradually shift their range northward, poleward, so north in the northern hemisphere and south in the southern hemisphere, or up the mountainsides, as Jason mentioned, as long as there's still more mountain above them. So a lot of our high elevation species have nowhere to go. They get forced right off the top of the mountain, and unless they jump over to a mountain farther north, they're stuck. They're gone. But there's another complication that interacts with climate change in a very big way is habitat losses and habitat changes, because we are changing the landscape. We as a human population around the world are changing the landscape virtually everywhere. And as we're also changing the climate, we're forcing the birds and other animals to adjust their geographic ranges into areas where the habitat may not be available because we've destroyed it, or we may have changed it. And habitat doesn't change quickly enough in response to climate change. So the birds may move to a better climate, but when they get there, the trees aren't right.
That's right.
Which also means the insects aren't right, and that's all gonna snowball.
It's called the Anthropocene era, the one that we're living in, which is being altered by human behavior, what we are doing. Let me read some comments. Let me get Jim on, and then I do want to talk about what people can do in their backyard or out their window to help birds. Nolan says, can your guest speak to the disappearance of the bobwhite quail in southern New Jersey? Is there a quick answer to that, Jason?
Well, bobwhite quail has disappeared in a lot of its range, so not just southern New Jersey, southern Michigan, where I grew up. You know, you'd walk around in an open farm field, you'd hear bobwhite quails whistling.
Bobwhite.
And they don't exist anymore in those places. Wow. So basically, the only bobwhites you see in southern New Jersey are birds that are part of a reintroduction program. There's an attempt to bring them back. But at this point, it's not a good situation. And a lot of this has to do with habitat, like Bob was talking about. In this case, our agricultural fields don't have a lot of edge. There isn't a lot of grassland along the edge of those fields. And if you don't have that habitat, you're not going to have bobwhites. So that's at least part of the picture.
Sure. Noel says on Facebook, humans are destroying the bird environment. I'm really disappointed to hear you and your guests blaming cats for the bird's sharp demise. I mean, I think we've talked about a number of threats. I don't think you can minimize what cats do, but obviously human beings having a huge impact on birds' survival and population, either growth or demise. Let me get Jim from New Britain to join us. And Jim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
I live in a suburban neighborhood that was developed in the 1960s. So there are plenty of mature trees around, and especially on my property, I have lots of mature trees of different varieties. And I used to hear early in the morning a cacophony of different bird sounds in the trees. And I realized this year that I'm not hearing any bird sounds at all. It's practically silent. And I'm wondering, is it possible that there was that sudden a decline, or was it something that was happening gradually and I just didn't realize until this year?
Jim, it's a good question. I'm tossing that to Robert Curry.
What that sort of observation might reflect is short-term changes, because the study that we started with was talking about changes over many decades, but there's also changes from year to year embedded in there as well. So those changes can be weather during the winter. If you have a severe winter, that can affect the wildlife populations in the subsequent year. In our chickadee research, for example, we've been now doing more than 20 years of research on chickadee populations in southeastern Pennsylvania. We had only about a quarter of the nests this year that we'd had in every other year previously. So something happened this year that knocked down our chickadees. This was both black-cap chickadee and Carolina chickadee, but also things like titmice and nuthatches. So a lot of the year-round resident forest birds in our area suddenly dropped. Now, we think they're going to bounce right back because the ones that didn't die had very good breeding success. They produced a lot of kids. And if you go to a bird feeder now, there are birds there. So they're popping right back up. We don't know what caused that drop. We think it's a real drop. We're actually studying that right now. But it could have been things like West Nile virus that comes in waves. And Jason can speak to that because he's a parasitologist. But that's the person that mentioned the blaming cats as opposed to other things that humans do. It's everything.
It's
multiplicative. It all piles up on top of each other. So climate change interacts with diseases, and then that in turn interacts with the habitat changes. So it goes in some very strange directions and gets complicated.
And, go ahead, Jason.
You know, when you going along these same lines, you know, when you have an island, for example, cats are really bad on an island, right? You've got this very limited population of birds, and we know cats have caused many island extinctions of birds. And what are our habitats like around here now? They're like little island patches. So we have a lot of cats around an island patch. It's going to cause the same thing, local extirpation of things from those patches.
I know you study parasites, and we could do a whole hour on that. I do want to just get – just so we understand, I guess, this relationship or what you are looking at, Jason, and I do want to just put out a couple of practical things that people can do in their own backyards. But what should we know about parasites in birds?
Well, I mean, there's a lot to know about parasites
in
birds.
I apologize. Yeah. I apologize
so,
for that.
So, you know, for example, the study that I'm collaborating with Bob on is actually looking at this movement of the hybrid zone between Carolina chickadees and black cat chickadees. And we know that that's correlated with climate change. But the question is, what's the proximate mechanism? So is there something that is causing that movement of those birds and the reduction of one population and the increase of the other, essentially replacing it? And one possible hypothesis is that parasites are involved. And this is something that's out there in the scientific literature. In other words, perhaps there is a malarial parasite. So we're studying malarial parasites. It turns out birds around here are loaded with malarial parasites. And one of those is the same genus that humans get, Plasmodium. And that, you know, that in many cases has caused problems for bird populations. The Hawaiian Islands is a famous example where an introduced malarial parasite has caused, you know, major extinction events. So
couple of minutes before we have to say goodbye. Robert Curry, if someone has a backyard, should they toss up a bird feeder and just would that be helpful or is it more complicated than that?
Well, bird feeders are great in terms of generating interest in birds and familiarity and understanding of birds. So I'm a fan. I have bird feeders in my house. It is important to put them in the right place. If you put them too close to a window, you can actually endanger the birds because they might bounce off the feeder and hit your windows. So there are ways to do it right, and there are some things to watch out for. You have to be careful. You have to clean them regularly. There are some bird diseases that can be transmitted very readily from one bird to another at a bird feeder.
Oh, interesting.
There's a mycoplasmum fungus disease that finches get, for example. But in terms of, is it helping birds in a big way to put bird feeders out? The jury's kind of out on that. You're kind of helping some species and not necessarily helping others. So you might be tipping some balances that we don't really fully understand. But in terms of backyard things that people can do, one of the ones that's turning out to be, there's recent research, including work on chickadees, that is quite convincing, is showing that native plants are very, very important, because if your backyard consists of all non-native plants, it's not going to have the normal set of insects that a lot of our birds rely on. And so this recent study showed that the health of the local populations across the Mid-Atlantic was much better in neighborhoods where the landscape was predominantly planted with native species, both trees and other garden plants.
Well, we could go on. Yeah. We have to end our conversation. My thanks to both of you, Robert Curry, Jason Weckstein. Thanks for coming in and talking about birds on Radio Times. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show was produced by Debbie Bilder, John Aronson, Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we close things out with the Slovak Radio Symphony Orchestra performing Camille Saint-Saëns' Carnival of the Animals, The Aviary.